Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today. Imminently, we'll be hearing from Adam Gaffney, the co-author of a proposal to get prescription drug prices down. And at the bottom of the hour, the economist Barry Eichengreen will talk about economic distress, the rise of the Trumpist International, and the future global role of the U.S. dollar. First, drugs, the therapeutic kind. As almost everyone knows, the cost of healthcare has been rising sharply for decades. The Consumer Price Index for Medical Care, which attempts to adjust for quality improvements to isolate pure price effects, is up almost 580% since 1980, over 2.5 times as much as overall inflation. Over the same period, prescription drug prices are up over 650%, almost 3 times the rate of general inflation. Why is this happening, and what can be done about it? My first guest, Adam Gaffney, is the co-author of a proposal, published a few weeks ago in the British Medical Journal, on how to get them under control. He's an instructor in medicine at the Harvard Medical School and a pulmonary and critical care physician at the Cambridge Health Alliance and is on the board of Physicians for a National Health Program. Adam Gaffney. Prescription drug prices, according to the Consumer Price Index, have been rising between 2.5 to 3 times the rate of overall inflation. Apologists for the industry will tell you it's because they're just creating all these wondrous new drugs and need all that money for R&D. What's driving prescription drug prices?
The biggest widely agreed upon factor is that these are government-granted patent monopolies that allow the industry to charge whatever it wants. The vast majority of the increase in drug prices is coming from brand-name drugs, even though we've had some spectacular stories of generic drugs like EpiPens and Martin Shkreli driving up generic prices. The spending is really coming from brand-name drugs. So we're seeing the industry put out smaller numbers of extremely expensive agents. And it's been able to get away with that because we don't have a drug pricing regime in this country that actually can bring down drug prices like they have elsewhere.
Let's talk a bit about the drug development process. Awful lot of basic research is funded by the government or, to a lesser extent, by universities. And it seems like a lot what the drug companies actually do is the D part of R&D. That is, they just take advances in basic research that's publicly funded and create commercial products out of them, or take existing drugs and just tweak a molecule here and there and create a new one at a higher price. Is that a fair picture of the process?
Yeah, I mean, you hit upon two really important issues there. First issue is the monetization of taxpayer-financed public research. So this goes back to the Bayh-Dole Act, which was passed in 1980, which basically allowed academic researchers to patent and sell their work products to industry so that drugs that were mostly developed in publicly financed labs could basically be taken the final mile by drug companies. And so that, in many ways, was the beginning of the sort of modern biopharmaceutical age as we now know it. And exactly as you put it, there was a study recently that basically showed that basically every new drug has at least some degree of taxpayer-financed public research behind it. So what drug companies do is they can sort of take the drug the final mile in terms of the development process. And most sort of costly, they do the clinical trials to prove efficacy. What we are seeing, though, is the monetization of public research. And this is something that has to come to an end. What was the second issue you raised?
A lot of the development part of drugs these days is just taking existing drugs and tweaking a molecule and have a patentable, higher-priced product as a result, right?
Exactly. And this is what people refer to as Me Too drugs. You can create a whole new innovative product that is going to really treat a new condition that has no existing treatments. Or why not just sort of create one more version of, you know, a statin or whatever that does basically the exact same thing as the existing drugs, plow money into advertising, plow money into marketing, plow money into detailing physicians, and then make the drug a blockbuster, even though you have not really added one iota of benefit to overall public health, given that the new agent is not an advance as compared to the existing armamentarium of drugs. So these are two major problems with the existing drug development process: monetization of public research and the creation of Me Too drugs. And this is the reason why, Doug, that it's not enough to talk about reducing drug prices when we talk about pharmaceutical reform. We have to also talk about reforming R&D.
You've mentioned two things there I want to pursue. One is how both aspects of marketing, but one is how they market to doctors. Detail. Tell us how the drug companies seduce the medical profession.
This is a long-standing problem, and if anything, it has come under a lot of justified scrutiny and criticism. But, you know, for a very long time, drug companies would distribute gifts to doctors, ranging from little things like pens to bigger things like meals to, you know, historically larger things like trips. They send agents to come speak with physicians, to provide data, to provide information, you know, and that's just sort of one aspect of detailing. There's also advertising in medical journals. There's also direct-to-consumer advertising. And then there's more, even more problematic things in my mind, which is sort of the industry funding of scientists who are the ones who are making guidelines, who are serving on journals that are sort of coming up with the recommendations for it to be used. That's a sort of higher level of corruption that we have to deal with as well.
There's been such a proliferation of direct-to-consumer advertising to the point where I've been seeing advertisements lately for this new, I don't think it's precisely a drug, but it is some sort of agent, to treat lung cancer, advanced cases of lung cancer, being advertised to consumers during athletic events. What is the point of that? You're supposed to say, you know, I'm dying of lung cancer, I want another few months, so prescribe this to me. What's the idea?
You know, direct-to-consumer advertising is a strange beast. It's illegal in the form we have it here. It's illegal in basically every country except for the United States and, for whatever reason, New Zealand. You know, I think that you touch on a good point, which is that really good drugs sell themselves for the most part. You know, if you come up with a tremendous cure, you're not really going to need to advertise it. People will be aware of it. I think that the more you need, you know, sort of the more marginal a drug is in terms of its benefits, the more aggressively it has to be advertised. You know, I think from the industry's perspective, they would argue this is a way of making individuals sort of aware of new treatments. Overall, though, evidence suggests that direct-to-consumer advertising, like other forms of pharmaceutical marketing, is misleading. It's low-quality information. I don't think you'll be surprised to hear that. And it's really not – certainly has no benefits in terms of overall public health. I think we should get rid of direct-to-consumer advertising. That would probably come up against a constitutional challenge that it may not be possible to directly ban it. But there are other things we can do to push back.
What is the role of drug prices in overall medical inflation? Like, there are many contributors to medical inflation, of course. Equipment, hospital fees, you know, just administrative fees. Every aspect of the American healthcare system is powered on excess. But what is the role of drug inflation compared to the rest of it?
Drug prices explain some difference in sort of American healthcare prices being higher than other countries. So as you say, we can't sort of boil down the American healthcare price absurdity just to the pharmaceutical system. You know, we spend about $360 billion a year is total just retail drug spending. One way to think about the excess is that we probably spend about twice as much on brand name drugs as other high income nations. Just doing sort of some simple math, we estimate that you could probably save about $150 billion a year if you were to reduce brand name drug prices to those paid by other high income nations. It's a contributing factor to healthcare inflation. It's by no means the only factor. And overall, reducing drug spending is going to be one way you can save money under a single payer system, for instance, but it is not the only way. Even a larger sort of waste in our system is, as you mentioned, administrative spending. Estimates are that under a single payer system, we could probably save about $500 billion a year if we were to have sort of administrative spending on the levels of that of Canada. So it's a component. It's an important component. It's by no means the only factor.
Our dear president issued a proposal a couple of weeks ago to control drug prices. He promised it would be really terrific and very effective. I believe the prices of drug stocks rose as he was speaking, which means that Wall Street didn't put much stock in what he was saying. But what did the president say, and what's wrong with it?
The reason why the drug stocks soared is because, first of all, they saw that he wasn't proposing anything that would seriously bring down drug prices. And second of all, I think they liked one thing that he said in particular, which could be a windfall for the industry. And that's that he argued that, you know, the U.S. should use its sort of trade power to help push up drug prices in other high-income nations. So, you know, as mentioned, countries that have a single payer or something similar use that power to bring down drug prices. The U.S. government sort of made an aggressive effort to fight back and push back and to sort of enshrine intellectual property rights, then you could see drug prices going up in other countries. So I think that's one of the things that it really liked. You know, and that would absolutely have no sort of benefit here. It's sort of ridiculous to think that just because the drug firms were increasing their profits abroad, they would sort of voluntarily and kindly decide to lower prices here. I don't really think that's how the world works. But I mean, there's a variety of other things that he talked. I mean, there's this long sort of plan that they published on they put up on the web that would detail various other steps that they wanted to take, sort of allowing pharmacists to talk to give information to consumers about the price of drugs, which is a tinkering kind of issue. They also mentioned allowing or requiring that drug companies include prices in advertisements, which I think is – I really don't know what the point of that is supposed to be. Like, what are you supposed to do if that lung cancer drug that you were mentioning at the end of the commercial, they say that it costs $20,000? Are you supposed to sort of decide if your life is worth it, if your life is worth $20,000? So that's, again, another example of one of these provisions that they put out there that really would have no – significant benefit. And there's a whole number of other ones. But really, from the big picture, as you said, the pharmaceutical stocks rose. They were overall happy with the plan. Let's not forget that on the campaign trail, Trump had at one point promised that he was going to allow Medicare to negotiate with drug prices. You know, this is something that the 2003 Medicare Modernization Act, which created the Medicare Drug Benefit Program, explicitly prevented the Bureau from the agency from doing. And that's something that basically is pretty common sense and that there's pretty broad support among the American public. He promised that, and not surprisingly, like so many other sort of economic populist claims he made, he's walked away from entirely.
Well, if we go back far enough, Trump endorsed single payer back in the early 2000s, I think. So,
yeah, you know, Trump sort of ran as a right-wing economic populist in some respects, but he's governing as just a sort of another sort of pro-corporate, pro-rich, whatever.
Yes, one can make a long list of words. So how could we get serious about controlling drug prices? You and your colleagues have been working on this, so give us some ideas.
Absolutely. So we published a sort of comprehensive sort of gold standard proposal in the British Medical Journal. It was a group of both U.S. and Canadian scholars and physicians. You know, actually, although we think of Canada as sort of getting this right and having lower drug prices, they have many of the same problems as well. Our proposal includes both smaller reforms and bigger reforms. The number one thing that we do need if we want to really get serious about bringing down drug prices, and this is something that's been discussed for a while, is to have a single payer, have a single government entity negotiate with drug companies on behalf of all of us. And as I mentioned, that could reduce drug prices by probably around $150 billion. But that's not enough. We talk about drug prices, but the way that we cover drugs is also critical. If you had drug prices that were half as much as they are now, but you still had the kind of co-payments and out-of-pocket costs and deductibles and co-insurance, these drugs would still be quite expensive, and people would still be squeezed and unable to afford them and have to make choices between, you know, rent and their lung cancer drug. So you need full coverage, obviously universal coverage, but we also need to eliminate cost sharing for prescription drugs. And this sounds very radical when I talk to people about it. They think that it's like against the laws of nature, but actually, they completely eliminated co-payments for drugs in Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales, and they contain drug costs very well. So that's the basics that we do need, and that's not going to be easy. And both of those would require a single-payer system. But there's a lot we can do even without a single-payer system. For instance, we talked about the problems in drug research and development. The NIH funds all this research, but then drug companies sort of do the development side, make a bundle, charge whatever they want, and we sort of get screwed. Well, there's no reason that we cannot have the NIH begin directly fund its own drug development, take drugs over the sort of the finish line. What that would mean is that they would directly fund, you know, non-profit or academic laboratories or in-house laboratories. The products that came out of these labs would remain in the public domain and would be generic and could be produced for low cost. We also should talk about having publicly funded clinical trials. We didn't get to this, but you know, there's a long history of clinical trials being set up in misleading ways by industry. It's not always a good idea to have the person testing a product who's the person who has stands to gain from it being a success. So we should talk about government-funded clinical trials. We need to do more to bolster the regulatory strength of the FDA. Under Bill Clinton, the FDA began to be partially funded by so-called user fees from the industry, meaning that the FDA is partially funded by industry. And that's, you know, makes absolutely no sense. And so we should go back to a fully publicly funded FDA to make sure that our drugs are maximally safe and effective. I could go on and on. Those are some of the things that we need to start talking about in the coming days.
I believe some of Trump's allies described the efforts of foreign governments to control drug prices as socialism. You mentioned that they wanted to try to persuade foreign governments to stop doing these things. But what would that look like? How would the government enter the marketplace and say, these prices are too high, get them down? How would that work?
Well, you know, you raise a good point, because we talk about drug negotiations as sort of a cure-all, but it's actually not quite that simple. All right. So the way that and many countries already do this, there's different ways that a government can sort of so-called negotiate. We use the term negotiate to kind of refer to all of it. I mean, and countries do different things. One is simply is in fact negotiate. If there's four different drugs that sort of do the same thing, the government can just sort of use its leverage and its buying power to sort of get the lowest price among the four drugs, and then put that drug on its formulary and exclude the other drugs that are not in that they can't get a good deal on. And even just through that approach alone, you can bring down drug price you can bring down drug prices significantly. Other countries sort of do other things, something called reference pricing. It's basically forms of regulating prices. But here's the downfall and the potential shortcoming of all of these approaches is that if there's a drug company that has the patent and owns a drug, and there's no great alternatives to that drug, one partner at that bargaining table has all the leverage, and that's the drug firm. And the drug firm can ultimately decide to walk away if it doesn't like the price that's being offered. And that can mean that drugs that have some utility that are very expensive get denied. And in our vision, all sort of medically necessary drugs should be covered. We shouldn't, I don't think that we need to talk about, you know, excluding things for low cost effectiveness, because it's only cost effective because of this sort of arbitrary price that the drug company has set. So we need other tools that will allow us to bring down drug prices. And some of these actually are already legal under current law. So for instance, the government can actually use compulsory licensing, where it essentially authorizes the generic production of a patented drug if it deems that it's sort of important from a public health perspective under existing law. So we think that in addition to these drug negotiations, the government needs to be willing to break patents when necessary, and even having some sort of public drug manufacturing capacity would also be greatly beneficial, especially as we're dealing with all these drug shortages, which is a separate issue. You really should be talking about it as a toolbox of different mechanisms to control drug prices on the one hand, and then another toolbox of mechanisms to sort of bolster innovation and to publicly fund research and development to make sure that we still are producing and innovating new and important drugs.
Well, yeah, that point is important because the industry would say that any attempt to control prices will put a squeeze on the development of new drugs, and it will only damage things over the longer term. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, I think that traditionally progressives have said that's not true. Profits are so high, drug prices are so high, we can reduce drug prices and have no impact on innovation. And I think that's true to a point. But there's no question that if you were to use the government's power to reduce drug prices, at some point, yes, you would reduce incentives for R&D. So I think it's reasonable to be honest about that. So there's two ways to sort of deal with that. One is to say, okay, well, we'll only bring drug prices down somewhat, but not that much. Or no, we will bring down drug prices aggressively, but at the same time, we will create a new public drug development capacity to replace any lost R&D and to actually refocus R&D on more innovative drugs and drugs that are dealing with issues that are of most, you know, sort of public health salience, as opposed to conditions that are the most profitable. So this is a sort of step away from this is so whereas I do think you can bring down drug prices without reducing R&D privately, I think if you're going to really be aggressive about it, it could reduce incentives to some extent, and that's why we need this sort of public R&D system, a parallel system that I'm talking about.
And finally, you're a doctor. How much do drug prices enter into the way you treat your patients? Do you have to make consideration of whether they can afford what you prescribe? Is that something that, you know, interferes with your daily practice?
It does not interfere with my daily practice, but it does because of where I work. I work at a health system that, you know, really cares about the underserved. And also, I work entirely in the inpatient setting in an ICU where I'm not sort of having these kinds of discussions. But let me tell you, this is definitely happening. And not only is it happening where doctors are having to consider the price of drugs when they prescribe drugs, this is being encouraged now. If you read the medical journals now, you'll be reading all these articles where people are talking about price transparency and the importance of doctors sort of taking into account patients' means and the price of drugs before prescribing treatments. And that sort of makes sense. Like, you can't be blind to that. But think about what the inevitable consequence of that is. The inevitable consequence of that is that your economic class determines what treatments you have access to. Right? It is class-based medicine. So it may be a necessity right now, and it probably is for physicians to be aware of all these issues and aware of costs, but this is an ugly place for us to be in. Again, it means that the quality of treatment you get may be determined by your economic means, not by your health needs. And I will say certainly that from colleagues who are in my field, let's say pulmonary medicine, the extraordinary price of inhalers for diseases like COPD, emphysema, asthma. This is definitely resulting in patients skipping medications, not filling prescriptions, not taking inhaled medications as prescribed. So I've definitely seen and heard this happening. It is basically everywhere. And some people in sort of the centrist establishment are actually encouraging the development of a more price-conscious approach to medicine, which might be one way to deal with the status quo, but it's not a way forward, and it's pretty ugly.
That was Adam Gaffney, who teaches at the Harvard Medical School, practices medicine at the Cambridge Health Alliance, and is on the board of Physicians for a National Health Program. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Drugs work.
Some of Drugs Work, a 2002 mix put together by Miss Kitten. Next, an analysis of what Yanis Varoufakis has called the Trumpist International. Barry Eichengreen, a professor of economics and political science at Berkeley, is just out with a book called The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era, from Oxford University Press. Eichengreen has written widely on economic history with a special focus on the economics and politics of currencies. While most of this interview is devoted to the rise of Trump and associated phenomena like Brexit and xenophobic nationalism in continental Europe, towards the end I ask some questions about what Trump might mean for the international role of the U.S. dollar. Here's Barry Eichengreen. Across what I guess we call the West, we have seen Trump, Brexit, the rise of AfD in Germany, neo-Nazis in the Austrian government, a new government that's a coalition of nationalists and clowns in Italy. Le Pen lost, but Macron took office and expanded his presidential powers and launched an attack on labor, which is probably not going to have very good results. What are the commonalities to all these events?
Well, I think the commonalities are dissatisfaction with the status quo and less than full understanding about what to do about it. So as an economist, I would start with economic factors, that there's a sense on the part of a large number of Trump voters and their counterparts in other countries of having been left behind, not shared in the economic growth of the last 20 years. There's a sense of insecurity, and there's anger at governments about not having done anything about it. And out of the mainstream politicians who can capitalize on that anger have been successful in a frightening number of different times and places.
A lot of these phenomena are often called populism. I know that the Financial Times loves that word. You use it in your book. Sometimes that reads like an elite sneer, dismissing popular concerns, popular resentments. Is that the right word to use?
The word has a long history to it. We had a famous populist revolt led by disaffected farmers, but also urban laborers who were feeling the insecurity of industrialization in the 19th century. There is a elitist strand to it in the sense that populist movements by definition are anti-elite, and when those of us who write about the issue and broadcast about the issue think about it, we realize that we're part of the problem to the extent that I think many of us had forgotten about how people lower down on the income scale had not been keeping up, and that government programs designed to assist them had been actively dismantled. And the conventional ways that we think people who are unhappy with their political leadership should respond, that's not the way the rank and file is responding. So I do think that there are some who use populism as a derogatory term. I don't think it's accurate or insightful to dismiss it in that way.
At least the American version, populism had, to use the modern taxonomy, projecting backwards, kind of left-wing and right-wing aspects. You know, there was an eagerness to regulate railroads, to loosen up on the tightness of the gold standard, redistributionist policies that would be broadly thought of as left, but then there was also, you know, racist and xenophobic strains to it as well. How do we sort these all out? I mean, it's a very contradictory and volatile category, it seems.
It is. So I think about populism as a political movement or ideology with three aspects to it. It's anti-elite, it's nativist or anti-other, and it has authoritarian tendencies because people who support populist leaders want someone who can put his foot down, metaphorically, and address the problem decisively. So we see in different leaders who are challenging the political mainstream and get labeled populist, these different aspects to differing degrees. We have left-wing populism, which is pronouncedly anti-elite. We have right-wing populism, which is anti-other, anti-immigrant, anti-foreigner. And occasionally we have populist leaders who combine both aspects and are hard to define. But I think in the last presidential election, Bernie Sanders had an element of populism, and the people versus the elites in his campaign rhetoric. And then we had Trump with his anti-other, anti-foreigner rhetoric, appealing to the right wing.
Sanders liked to call himself a socialist or a democratic socialist. Most socialists wouldn't necessarily accept his self-categorization, but you know, he did come out of a coherent social democratic kind of tradition, which of course also has a long history in Western Europe as well. You don't talk all that much about socialism or social democracy in your book, more about populism and elite politics. But what about the role of that kind of, that critique, the socialist or social democratic critique of inequality and insecurity?
We don't have much of a history of socialism or even social democracy in the United States. Where we do see it, where it's deeply embedded, of course, is in Europe. And there I do talk about it. And I think one reason to be relatively confident that European countries are going to be able to head off the most destructive forms of populism, where clowns take out after the elites or fascists take out against foreigners, is that social democracy in principle is a coherent response to the insecurity people feel as a result of technological change and globalization. So both social democracy and Christian democracy in Europe are collective movements where people acknowledge that government has to correct the flaws in the market economy, and privileged people have an obligation to help the less privileged. That's not rhetoric that flows freely off the tongues of American politicians of either party. So I'm much more worried about our ability to deal with underlying social problems and disaffection in the United States than I am about Europe, where social democracy and Christian democracy provide vehicles for responding.
What do you think the contribution to the rise of this right has been, the move of a lot of the center-left parties, the Democrats in the U.S., the social democratic parties in Western Europe, to embrace markets, liberalization, you know, whatever you want to call it, neoliberalism? We had Blair in the Third Way, joining with Clinton here, promoting Wall Street in the city of London. In Germany, you had Schröder's government promoting the growth of a low-wage labor force. So working-class voters, and you look at, for example, a lot of the votes for Le Pen came out of traditionally socialist and communist regions and demographic groups. What's the contribution of that move by the center-left parties in the West towards a much more aggressively pro-capitalist line?
I think they have a lot to answer for, and it's not only the parties and the politicians, but it's the thought leaders as well. So we academics, we economists, did too little to remind ourselves and the public that globalization doesn't automatically raise all boats, that the creative destruction of technological change doesn't always benefit everyone. It doesn't benefit the coal miners if they don't get the training they need to move into other occupations. We didn't convey that message. I think globalization is here to stay. We cannot turn back the clock on technical change. The market economy has a lot of benefits and does a lot of people a lot of good, but the social programs that make that change tolerable need to be maintained as well, and I think that message was forgotten.
Now, even in conventional economic theory, people who advocate liberalization of the trade regime, for example, recognize that there are winners and losers and that the losers need to be compensated somehow. It seems that the liberalization won and the compensation got forgotten. What happened there?
Well, I think part of it was that only simple messages like let the market work are easy to communicate. The urgency of doing something for people whose wages were stagnating was less before the global financial crisis, that people could take out jumbo mortgages and buy homes they couldn't afford because of the way we mismanaged the financial system. Once the financial crisis hit and households had to begin to work down all that debt and could no longer live beyond their means, reality kicked in and made for uncomfortable politics.
Now, Trump, he certainly uses a lot of the traditional language of populism. His resentment of elites, his ability to translate his Queens outer borough resentment against Manhattan elites into something that spoke somehow to displaced machinists in Wisconsin. But you know, he's doing a very contradictory set of policies. On the one hand, you've got his tariffs, which themselves are not very coherent. I mean, it's protecting industries that are rather small and damaging industries that can be rather large. But at the same time, you know, he's deregulating environmental policy. He's providing big tax cuts to rich people and corporations. What's the economic effects of this policy going to be, and what are the political ramifications coming from it, do you see?
Well, I think the economic effects will not be good. That the tax act that the Congress and the passed and the president signed in December is going to be primarily benefiting the rich. I think the deregulatory policies that are not classic populist acts, but are the centerpiece of Trump's economic policy, such as it is, are going to be benefiting business and shareholders and the wealthy as well. So there, I do worry deeply that when Trump supporters figure out that the president's policies are not benefiting them, where are they going to turn next? Are they going to turn back toward the center and the political mainstream and established politicians, or seek an even more dangerous politician further out of the mainstream?
It's kind of hard to imagine people going back to the center-left parties, which now seem deeply discredited, both in Western Europe and here. You know, we did see Sanders tap into a different kind of politics in the United States, Corbyn tapping into a different kind of politics in Britain, but not much of that sort of thing happening in continental Europe. So what are the possible alternatives if this stuff goes bad?
If this stuff goes bad, well, I think we've seen an example of that in Italy, where it did go bad for the better part of 20 years. They basically had no income or productivity growth for two decades. The main center-left and center-right parties are both dead in Italy. And it will be interesting to see what happens when the new coalition government falls apart, as it almost certainly will sooner or later. There, I think what you can get end up with is a hard-right government. The League, the Lega, and Silvio Berlusconi's party together, and that wouldn't make for a happy outcome. But I'm not sure that we know the answer to your question. We can be confident that the answer is not going to be the same everywhere. A lot depends on the institutions, on the structure of the economic and political system. Some countries have more robust electoral systems than others. So the French system allowed all the supporters of mainstream candidates to ally against Marine Le Pen in the second round when there were only two candidates. Other systems like Italy's are less robust.
I'm speaking with Barry Eichengreen, who's a professor of economics at Berkeley and author of The Populist Temptation from Oxford University Press. Trying to figure out the rise of these kind of politics, people have been debating both in Europe and here the relative contributions of identity issues around immigration or race or gender and economic anxiety. Some people think that those are, you know, mutually exclusive propositions. How do you sort that out? What are the relative contributions of these two strands?
I think they almost always come together. So in the 19th century in the U.S., the economic insecurity, it wasn't so much lack of economic growth as commercialization of farming and the insecurity the farmers felt about not being able to control their own destiny went together with fear of new immigrants, whether they were Chinese immigrants to California or Southern and Eastern European immigrants to the Eastern Seaboard. So I think in almost all cases there's an identity element together with economic element. I'm an economist. I tend to start with the economics and argue that when there are festering economic problems, that creates an opportunity for politician to come riding in and say these problems are attributable to the other, to the immigrants, to the group that is challenging the not only the established identity and culture of the country, but also purportedly creating these economic problems. I would start with the economics, but I wouldn't deny the importance of the identity part.
Parenthetically, you're an economist, but for an economist, you're unusually interested in history and things other than vector autoregressions. I mean, what about the profession? You know, we've sort of elevated economists to a great status over the last 20, 30 years. Is the profession, you know, has some difficulties in understanding the world because of this narrowness of interest?
The profession has gotten caught up in theoretical elegance, but two things have come along to begin to modify that. I'm an optimist now about where economics is going. Number one, the global financial crisis was, in fact, a wake-up call and led people to reflect on how the profession missed it and what we could be doing better. And number two, big data, that if you look at what the best young economists are doing, the graduate students, they're all doing empirical work using big data that can be harvested from the web and addressing real-world problems rather than grinding away at abstract theory. You're going to have to remind me who it was who said science advances one death at a time. That's how it will be in economics, that the young people coming up are going to have to remake the field, and they probably will.
So what can we do about these problems? It seems like we really have to confront a whole lot of structural issues in order to prevent, a rerun of 1914 onwards.
Well, I think we basically know what the elements are. The problem is that the fix will take time, that we're unavoidably, all of us in the United States, in Europe and elsewhere, living in a globalized world. Technological change is accelerating, even though it's not all yet showing up in everybody's pay packet. So talking my own book, it starts with education and training, not only university education, but, you know, early childhood education, giving people vocational training, figuring out what kind of jobs are going to survive artificial intelligence and better equip people, give them the communication and empathy-related skills they need in order to be productive in those jobs. I think it's better to subsidize wages and work than to give people a universal basic income, because not only are skills transmitted to people on the job, but socialization skills are as well. So those would be the most basic elements, talking about how to get people into work, and if robots are competing people out of work, subsidize their wages and give people the education and training they need to compete with the apocryphal Chinese worker.
To make any kind of material dent in this polarization and instability that people are experiencing, you're going to need capital investment by the private sector, public investment, infrastructure and such. And we have a corporate sector that seems more interested in stock buybacks than long-term capital investments, and rich people completely unwilling to pay taxes to fund anything like a public investment. We just first quarter saw the lowest effective corporate tax rate in history. I think it's down about 12% now. How do we confront those things which seem completely intransigent now?
I do think the United States of America is moving in the wrong direction in many of those respects. So we're cutting spending on a variety of forms of education and training. We're not doing the infrastructure investment that we need. Part of the answer is that some of these things can be done at the state level. If you live in the sixth largest economy in the world, like I do, there is scope for investing in infrastructure, attempting to levy higher taxes on the wealthy. I'm not convinced that everybody in Silicon Valley is going to move to Nevada or New Zealand in response to higher taxes. There are limits on what states can do, but there's scope for acting locally.
And now to take a little detour, I read over your, over the weekend an earlier book of yours, Exorbitant Privilege. You know, you concluded from that the dollar had some problems as the world central currency, but that the strength of the United States and you know, the Chinese are certainly not ready yet. and the EU, well, the euro doesn't seem to be quite ready for prime time either as a rival to the dollar. But we're seeing the Trump administration really attacking the credibility of the United States economically and politically in such ways that were hard to imagine when you wrote that book. What's your opinion now on the status of the dollar over the longer term?
The only thing supporting the dollar and its international role at the moment is, as you said, that there are no viable alternatives, that the euro is about to lapse back into crisis due to Italy, and China has had to tighten its capital controls, and that sets back the progress of renminbi internationalization. So the dollar remains, for the moment, the only game in town. But I do think that fraying geopolitical alliances and volatile, uncertain policies are going to be very bad for the dollar long term. The dollar's appeal lies in part in the fact that the United States is a safe haven. So whenever a bad thing happens to the world economy, people rush into dollars, and we get in the United States an automatic form of insurance. With Trump, it's not clear that we're going to remain a safe haven. If you look at the historical data, other countries and foreign central banks hold as their international reserves mainly the currencies of their geopolitical alliance partners. The South Koreans and the Japanese hold more dollars than their trade with an investment in the United States would lead one to expect. So if we're no longer a reliable alliance partner, they're going to diversify their bets, increasingly move out of dollars into something else as soon as that something else becomes available.
But now the renminbi is not ready to step into that role yet, is it?
No, it isn't. Most obviously, it's still hard to get in and out of Chinese financial markets. Those markets are volatile and not as liquid as ours. And finally, there is an argument that every international and reserve currency in history has been the currency of a political democracy or republic, that foreign investors want to see checks and balances on arbitrary powers of the executive, so their foreign investments can't be expropriated arbitrarily. People have reason to worry about that in what is an increasingly centralized authoritarian China.
Someone looking at the dollar might worry the same about Trump.
Indeed. So, you know, then you've got to ask the question, if there's no reliable source of international liquidity, neither dollars nor renminbi, what greases the wheels of international trade and finance? And at some point, the answer could be nothing.
And at this point, is the EU salvageable? Is the euro salvageable, or is it all going to come flying apart?
The euro has shown itself to be like Hotel California, that you can check in, but you can't check out. There is no exit clause. Already the new coalition in Italy has softened its anti-euro rhetoric because the bond markets responded so negatively. I think there is scope for salvaging the euro. Mrs. Merkel gave a newspaper interview over the weekend describing her modest proposals for strengthening the euro area. There will be a point, I think, where the Chancellor and President Macron can come together and progress can be made. So I'm still, for better or for worse, betting on the euro.
And can the euro survive without some loosening of German austerity?
It would be desirable to have a loosening of German austerity, and it would be desirable to let the Italians proceed with a modest fiscal stimulus on condition that they also do structural supply-side reforms. So it's not exclusively about German fiscal policy, but it's about European fiscal policy more broadly.
Finally, I was just reading the passage from Keynes's Economic Consequences of the Peace this morning. He was talking about a resident of London in 1914 being able to order all the products of the world with his telephone and have them delivered by that afternoon, and that this state of affairs was going to go on forever. The only change would be in the direction of continuous improvement. Then it all promptly came flying apart. How pessimistic should we be about a repeat of that kind of scenario 104 years later?
As Keynes was alluding to in that quote, today globalization is very deeply embedded in our economies and societies, and it would be extremely costly to blow think everybody understands the benefits they get from imported goods. The automakers are well aware of, in the U.S., how much they rely on assembly and parts and the like from Mexico and Canada. So they oppose Trump's auto tariffs. All the economic arguments, I think, point in the direction of globalization being successfully sustained. But the politics have to cooperate, and I think that means articulating a set of policies that can deal with casualties of globalization, the people who don't benefit proportionately. Otherwise, politicians like Trump will carry the day.
That was Barry Eichengreen, a professor of economics and political science at Berkeley. His book, The Populist Temptation, Economic Grievance and Political Reaction in the Modern Era, is just out from Oxford University Press. I'm not sure that more education and training are the route to pushing back against the neo-fascist threat, but Eichengreen is certainly no radical. In the interview, Eichengreen quoted a famous maxim, science advances one death at a time, and leaves crediting its origin to me. It's a common paraphrase of a much less punchy remark by the German physicist Max Planck, made famous by Thomas Kuhn in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die, and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of that old reliable Heaven 17's We Don't Need No Fascist Groove Thing from 1980. Till next week, bye.
This fascist groove thing, evil men with racist views, spreading all across the land. Don't just sit there on your ass and look at funky chain dance. Brothers, sisters, shoot your best. We don't need this fascist groove thing.
Brothers, sisters, we don't need that fascist groove thing. Brothers, we don't need the fascist today.
History will repeat itself. Crisis point, we're near the hour. Counterforce will do no good. Hard you as I feel your power.